This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Garden Show with Charlie Dobbin, heard every Saturday morning at 9 on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. Welcome, friend, to our weekly garden party. We hope you brought along your questions because it's time to dish the dirt. On The Garden Show with Charlie Dobbin, exclusively on Zoomer Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to The Garden Show. Here I am in my home office in Prince Edward County, looking out the window, and for one of it's a rare day. Excuse me, it's a rare day because the sky is not absolutely crystal blue. We have had so much sun this summer. It's just been an amazing year for all the sun-loving annuals and perennials and vegetables. But today we've got some clouds, so I'm very excited. I'm hoping we really will get some rain. We did, I'm happy to say, did get about 2 centimeters of rain a few days ago, and that was super bonus because as for regular listeners of the show, you'll know it's been dry at my place. We've had an extensive lack of rain and we have crispy lawns and our well went dry. So now we've had two, it only went dry once. But we've had, and of course we brought in the water truck and had the big tanker fill up the well. And then we did another fill up this past week because we are watching the well and we realized that even though we're being so, so careful and using so little water, but you know, you have to use some water, it's still going down. It's still going down about 6 inches a day. Now I am having to water the garden plants and trees, things that I planted last fall. I mean, this is really just the first year for so much, for all of my garden plants. So I am TLCing them a fair amount, and that's, you know, the water does go out on that. So anyway, water comes in, water goes out. Here's a cute quote somebody just sent me. We don't talk about trees getting older. We say they're growing. So let's use that same term for ourselves. We're not getting older. We're just growing. So that's pretty cute. I will give out the numbers quickly before we go off to our first break, but I will let you know we're having some technical issues back at the station. So I'm not positive if we can actually get anybody on the phone, but I'm going to answer some email. And if you want to call, you will be on hold, and hopefully we will be able to get you on air. Local call number, as you know, is 416-360-0740. And if you're outside the local calling area, it's 866-740-4740. Carlos is in charge there. He's doing his best to try to hold it all together. Feels a bit like duct tape and baling wire at this point, but we're going to have a good day. You know, we're talking gardening. We have lots to talk about. So we'll be back in a minute to answer some of your email.
Don't change stations just because the weather changes. Garden tips and advice all year round. This is The Garden Show with Charlie Dobbin, exclusively on Zoomer Radio.
Yes, indeed. Gardening all year round. And we've still got lots of gardening to do this fall. Think about it. We're, you know, so far away from being able to really put our tools away. I have had a number of questions about things like crabgrass. This has also been a great year for crabgrass. So remember, now is the time. If you can pull crabgrass, do so. It's very shallow rooted. It grows in little clumps. At this time of year, the grass stems are kind of a purple color right down at the surface of the soil. And there's little clumps, and they're starting to flower. And the sneaky thing about crabgrass is that when it flowers, we call the grass stems or leaves prostrate. They are lying right on the ground, and of course, the flower stems are doing the exact same thing. So all the mowing in the world is never going to get those flower heads cut off. You need to pull the crabgrass if you can. Now, the reason why is because, well, plants will die. Those are annual plants. Those mother plants will die, but before they die in the winter, they're going to pop out thousands and thousands of seeds, which are going to grow next spring. So best, if you can, to pull crabgrass now. But remember, we had a call last week from, it was on the subject of vinegar. Who was that? Oh, yes, Barb gave us a call from Aiden, and she was wondering about vinegar as a herbicide. So I did a little bit of quick research, and I realized there's an awful lot of vinegars out there of different. Remember, what is vinegar? A vinegar is acetic acid. So a different concentration of acetic acid is available for different purposes. For our French fries, it's, I think, about a 3 or 4% solution of a concentration, I should say, of acetic acid that we put on and enjoy. For cleaning, you'll see a 10% acetic acid type availability. But then I even saw on the web 75% acetic acid. Now, that is one potentially caustic or could really burn things. However, the bottom line is vinegar kills plants. So going back to the crabgrass, if you have patches of crabgrass and you're just overwhelmed and think, I have no idea how I can pull these out, it's just not possible, consider spraying vinegar on the crabgrass. That it will work. There's a UBC, the University of British Columbia Botanical Garden, has a forum that I just happened to fall into, and somebody was asking about vinegar and does it work? Well, here is the bottom line. Through this forum, there's a good answer. It just says, if you want a green solution to weeds that actually work, this person who's writing says, I can confirm that white pickling vinegar. So pickling vinegar is a 7% acetic acid solution. Now, this is quite an old post. Since then, cleaning vinegars have become quite trendy, and they're usually about 10%. Makes an amazing plant killer, and it does. I can confirm that as well. I've definitely used vinegar in my interlocking, little weeds coming up in the interlocking stones and bricks. It kills quite effectively. Now, big tap-rooted old dandelions, not going to kill that overnight with one spray, but yes, indeed, you can spray more than once. Remember, vinegar kills everything. So if you're going to use vinegar as a killer, then consider that you're very, very careful to not spray vinegar on any of your garden plants. That's the real bottom line. Your garden plants will also suffer extreme damage if they are sprayed with vinegar. Of course, if there is rain in the forecast, wait. Don't spray vinegar just before rain. Try and wait till after the rain. And there's kind of a cute tip here that somebody had this massive amount of weeds, and she says, I'm going to hack a Swiffer wet jet mop so I can refill it with vinegar and use its built-in battery-powered sprayer to do large areas conveniently. And this is a person with gravel trails in the back of the property and wants to keep the gravel trails vegetation-free. So the spray bottle does get tiresome, so I'm going to use a battery-powered Swiffer mop. I thought that was pretty funny. It's a good idea, Be creative. I am back at school. My voice might sound a bit tired today. I was teaching all day yesterday, starting at 8 o'clock in the morning. So lectured from 8 o'clock in the morning till 11 a.m. via virtual, so over the computer. And then I was on campus with my first year students for the first day, first lab yesterday afternoon. And it's going to be a fun semester. I do enjoy teaching and the students and all the kind of stories they bring with them into the classroom. So we'll be having some fun there. Let's take a moment here and have one more quick break, and we'll come back and I'll see if I've got some good email to share with you. Stay tuned.
Fur and feathers and bugs of all size. There's more going on in the garden than you realize. Should small creatures become a big problem, then you've got The Garden Show with Charlie Dobbin. Exclusively on Zoomer Radio.
All right. So you'll notice I'm not really pushing the phone numbers because at this point we are having some technical issues in the studio. So we are not confident that we can actually hook phone calls and me together, because remember, I'm out in my home office in Prince Edward County. So you're going to listen to me. I'm going to ramble on about all kinds of things that I have found interesting this week. Here's one. Anybody having fruit flies flying around your kitchen? Because it is the time of year where we're bringing in apples and, well, in our house, feels like bushels of tomatoes, and there's just a lot of fruit and vegetables, and windows are open, of course, the weather's beautiful, and flies are coming in and out, but fruit flies, you get one and then you've got 100, it seems. So we were doing the fruit fly battle, and then I remembered a trap that is so simple and it works so well. I put it together in mere seconds, and actually probably the simplest trap is just a little bowl, like a little custard dish. You don't need much, half an inch of preferably any kind of vinegar, but a smelly vinegar, like a cider vinegar is the best. A drop of soap, just dish soap, on top of that vinegar. Don't stir it up or anything. Just let it sit out on your counter. The flies are very attracted to the vinegar. And of course, the soap acts as it changes the surface tension of the liquid so that they can't, once they step down, settle their little wings and their little feet down onto the liquid because they're so interested in that vinegar, they pop right through because of the surface tension change caused by the soap, and they can't get out. I didn't do that trap. The trap I did was just simple vinegar, little jar, plastic wrap over the top, elastic band around the top of the jar, and I poke a bunch of little holes into the plastic wrap. No soap, just straight vinegar. And the fruit flies will be quite interested. They'll pop down through the holes in the plastic wrap, and then they can't get out, so they eventually drown inside the jar. And then you clean it out and start again. Or when I discovered by a total fluke, if you have an empty wine bottle sitting on your counter because you've been too lazy to take that wine bottle out to the garage or the shed, that empty wine bottle is a fruit fly trap. So the fruit flies will fly down into the bottle because they're quite attracted to the residue of wine. And the narrow neck of the bottle acts as a very interesting way to not let them out. So, you can just, super simple. Just leave out some empty wine bottles, and you too can be a fruit fly farmer if you wish to be. Something to put on your calendars for next week is I will be in studio next week, and I will have with me a special guest. Her name is Lori DeMonte. She runs a company, it's a design, garden design, garden install, and garden maintenance company called Who Does Your Garden? So Who Does Your Garden? She named her company Who Does Your Garden because she felt that really summed up what she does. She does a beautiful job, and the first thing any passerby or visitor will say when they see one of the gardens that Lori has tended or designed, they'll say, wow, Who Does Your Garden? So that's the name of her company. And she'll be joining us next week. She's going to tell us a little bit about how she got into this business, this crazy horticultural business, which is something that I know my students are always kind of interested in. And she'll be here also just to share some of her tips and some of the things she's learned out in people's gardens, and some of the things she's seeing, good things and not so good things that are being done. Some of the, she does both commercial and residential garden design and maintenance. So I think Lori's going to bring some interesting an interesting voice to the show for next week. So put that on your calendar. Here's one more thing from last week. Remember Ken called from Oakville, and he was trying to figure out how to save Datura seeds, so angel's trumpet seeds. And he was just having challenges with being able to save those seeds. Datura seeds tend to kind of explode out of the pods. And he was really wanting to keep those seeds in order to grow for next year. And I did get an email from Annette in North Tonawanda, New York, who heard Ken's question. And she said she always just keeps her Datura going from cuttings. So that was a good point. I hadn't sort of thought of that. I was so concentrating on the seed question, I neglected to mention to Ken that you can always easily take those tip cuttings from the plants you love. And I think that is a good tip for everybody right now. If you've got hibiscus, you've got oleander, you've got mandevilla, you have tropical plants that are large, they're beautiful, you've loved them all summer, but you just cannot bring them inside. You don't have room, or you don't have enough light inside to keep these plants alive in the big form, consider cuttings right now. It's a great backup plan, even if you plan to do both. Maybe you do have an ability to bring them in, but you're not positive they'll survive the winter. Well, right now, and sooner is better than later, take those tip cuttings. So 4 to 6 inch cuttings off the tips of the plants. If there's flowers there, remove flowers. Remove lower leaves, and where the leaves have been removed, you've got little bumps on the stems. Bumps are called nodes. Get those nodes underwater or into a moist perlite or a moist peat moss, and into a not too hot, not too sunny location, preferably actually kind of a cooler location, bright but not direct sunlight. And roots will grow fairly quickly from cuttings. And depending on the plant, water is very, very simple. But you know, geraniums, sometimes a lot of people like to keep their geraniums. So again, if you can't keep the big plant, consider cuttings now, and then you will be ready to go to really propagate them next spring. So that's just a thought for those of you who are wanting to propagate plants. And a lot of us do. We have favorite plants. We don't want to see them disappear. And they're expensive, right, to keep buying. Also coming up this week, I've told you a little bit about the documentary Healing Gardens. So Healing Gardens is a 10-episode documentary being produced by the mothership there at Zoomer Media. So it's Zoomer Media is heading up the production of Healing Gardens. And eventually, once we get all the episodes made and edited and ready to show you, they will be shown on Vision Television. And I will tell you, of course, when that's happening. But for now, we're still in production, and we're off to the Royal Botanical Gardens this week to do one more episode. We're getting there. We're up to episode 9, as far as I know. And but who's counting? So we will be discovering some of the lovely gardens of the Royal Botanical Gardens. And it's neat, you know, I used to haunt that RBG and go there often just because it's such a lovely, lovely, massive garden or series of gardens. But they have spent quite a bit of money on some redesigns. The Rose Garden is phenomenal. I was there for the grand opening of the Rose Garden about 3 or 4 years ago. And the Hendry Park Garden down, the Hendry Rock Garden. Again, massive renovation of that one. I was there for that opening, too, because that is amazing. But one I haven't seen and I'm looking forward to is they have installed a healing garden. And it's got hundreds and hundreds of plants from all over the world. And they always had a sort of a medicinal garden, which was a collection of plants that had traditionally been used for medicinal purposes. But now they've really reorganized that into a healing garden. So that is going to be fun to see. And to obviously talk to the people there, who the volunteers, the staff at the Royal Botanical Gardens, and get some of their feedback on how these gardens affect visitors, how they feel as staff working in these gardens, and you know, some of the medicinal uses and some of the stories, the worldwide stories of where these plants come from and how they've been used. So that's exactly what I was talking to my students about yesterday, was going way back to the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. I mean, gardens have been around for a very long time. And of course, they have always been used for medicine. They've been used for food. They've been used for clothing. They've been used for our structures, for our homes. So, and they still are. So, you know, everything starts with plants. Everything starts with plants, just so you know. You wouldn't have a leather belt made from a cowhide if you didn't have plants for that cow to eat, to grow up the cow to become your belt. Everything starts with plants. It's a magical thing, but plants are just that magical. Righto, here's let's do a little bit of email, because like I said, it's just at this point still impossible for me to be able to get you online. Excuse me while I clear my throat. Yes, my voice is a little tired. I can hear it. But here's an email from Connie Brown. And this is a fairly old email, I'm afraid to say. I haven't read it in quite a while. Connie says she does listen to the show faithfully, needs some advice. How do I shape and prune this hydrangea bush? So there is a photograph of this hydrangea, and it's become overpowering. She'd like to train it to grow into a nice shape. And she also comments that she had heard me referring to one of the gardens that we visited, again, as part of the Healing Gardens episodes, the conifer garden near Hamilton. And it is called Whistling Gardens. So whistle, like, so Whistling Gardens is where we were, and it is near Hamilton. It's actually nearer to Brantford, yes, Brantford than Hamilton. And it is a wonderful garden. If you are looking for an outing this weekend, They are open, and they are wonderful, lovely, lovely people. I haven't looked to see what's special going on, but they have events all the time. So there may be something fun going on at Whistling Gardens this weekend. Check them out. And going back to, yes, Stephen Biggs, the author of the book, The Fig Pig. Yes, indeed, that Stephen Biggs, Stephen with a V, not a PH, and Biggs with two Gs, is a fig guy. So if you're interested in learning more about figs, because, and Stephen was on the show not that long ago and brought me some figs. Yes, he knows a lot about figs. You can always contact Stephen very simply through his website, which is Food Garden Life. That's one word, foodgardenlife.com. Remember, his daughter Emma is the tomato grower, and you can contact her through emmabiggs.ca. She's got a great blog. She tells great stories, and she is one busy young lady, 16 years old, full-time student, and full-time tomato grower. So she's somebody to be very, very impressed with how hard she works and how engaged she is. But sorry, Connie, going back to your hydrangea, it looks to me like the hydrangea you're growing might be one called Hydrangea and the Cultivar's Phantom. They have absolutely huge blooms, and this sort of scraggly looking hydrangea you're growing is something with huge blooms. So here's what you're going to do. If you can just leave it alone for now and for the winter, you know, it's going to look like what it looks like, but the blooms I find quite ornamental throughout the winter. But come spring, that's when you get out your pruners. On a nice dry day, you are going to do a pretty hefty pruning on this plant. So go back, like you're going to have to look at where all those various branches are coming from. And if you want it to be a shrub, remember that's multiple stems coming out of the ground. If you want it to be a tree, you're going to train it to one single stem coming out of the ground with multiple stems growing above the single stem so that it's, you know, the shape of a lollipop, if you will. But it is a spring pruning. It's before the leaves emerge. So depending on the weather, it might be April, it might be May, it's a nice dry day, and the buds are starting to show, so you can see the little green buds on the branches of the hydrangea. Now you start cutting back to an outward-facing bud. Well, in this case, actually, these hydrangeas don't have outward-facing buds per se because the buds are opposite on the stems. So you will actually cut down to pairs of buds that are going to grow sideways, not inwards. You want to avoid any growth to the inside of the plant. So you might even ultimately be doing just that. So you've only got single branches growing outwards. But either way, remove any of that inward growing growth, and don't be afraid to prune the whole thing down. You know, I used to have a lime-like hydrangea at my last house, and it wanted to be 8 feet tall and 8 feet wide. And I was fighting with it because I wanted it to be 5 feet tall and 5 feet wide. And every spring I' 'd cut it down to about, you know, 3.5, 4 feet. But every year it went to its 8 feet. It was like, I don't care what you want, I'm going for 8 feet. So some of these hydrangeas get very, very large, particularly if they're in lots of sun. Like these are the not the round mop head hydrangeas. These are more the conical flowering hydrangeas. So they will grow and give us real great show in terms of their flowering, but they do need lots of sun and space to grow because some of them do get large. I liked my limelight so much I've got another one planted here in my new garden here in the county. Another email from Horace Watson, and Horace excuse me, says, "Hi, Charlie. I'm a regular listener of your show every Saturday when possible and find it super informative. This is from early August, so hopefully Horace is listening today. Please help me with my red delicious apple tree, which I have now for a very long time. When I prune it after reaping the fruits, what I notice of late is it becomes very bushy and provides no fruits whatsoever the following year. What am I doing wrong? Have a good day and await your response." So Horace, number one, we don't prune our apple trees after we harvest the fruit. So we harvest our apples in late summer and fall. We prune our apple trees in late winter or very early spring. So you look for, again, a dry day. It could be February, it could be March. So it's very much late winter, early spring. The plant is dormant. There's no growth on it whatsoever. You can very very easily with any of your fruit trees, study the structure of the tree and do a certain amount of standing back and looking at it and deciding what needs to be removed. With a Red Delicious apple, there are different ways to prune. There's some very good books written on the subject. There's some excellent YouTube videos on pruning fruit trees in general, but apple trees specifically. Red Delicious, we typically will prune to a central leader. That means there's a central terminal branch that grows up to the sky, and that is your central leader. Most deciduous trees, that's the form that we choose, and we encourage that form with our pruning. Fruit is born on spurs. What are spurs? Those are those little stubby branches that grow only about a quarter of an inch a year. So what you're getting is those, what we call water spouts. By that late summer pruning that you're doing, Horace, you're encouraging the exact wrong kind of growth. So avoid that late summer pruning. Prune out all those water spouts in the spring. And, of course, you want to leave those little spurs. And the spurs are a very different kind of growth. They're very, very dense, little short branches, very, very stubby. And it's from those branches that you'll get flowers. So watch, of course, enjoy your flowers while they're happening. Watch the pollination happen. See the little tiny, tiny apples starting to form. Once you see those little tiny apples, you could have as many as 3 or 4 apples where the flower clusters were, and then you need to do some thinning of your fruit. The best, believe it or not, is take it down to 1 apple per flower cluster. That way you will get your best, biggest fruit, you know, juiciest apples, and your least amount of competition and your least amount of disease, because you'll have better air circulation and sun penetration when you have 1 apple per flower cluster. Okay, Horace, I hope that helps. And we'll have to take a short break, but we will be right back. I'll be right here. I'm not going anywhere. You stay tuned and stay tuned for some more email, or maybe, just maybe, we can get to the phone.
Daffodils and daisies, bluebells and begonias, forsythia and foxgloves, marigolds, magnolia, lavender and lupins, dahlias, delphiniums, stocks, fox, hollyhocks, tulips and sweet williams.
You've picked the right place for everything floral. This is The Garden Show with Charlie Dobbin, exclusively on Zoomer Radio.
Hello, and here we are. Yes, indeed, we're talking gardening. My goodness, it's a perfect day. It's not hot. It's not raining yet at my place. We are anticipating and expecting some rain, and I am very, very excited. So listen, if you have been hoping that you could call in and speak with me and ask a personal direct question about your garden, I'm afraid that we are having some issues there at the studio, and just you're going to have to listen to me ramble on and answer some email this week. We'll be back up and running with lots of calls from you next week. And so don't hang on hold or try and get online. It appears that the computer issues are rather large and will not be solved in the next 15 minutes. But I've got email, so thanks for all these great email. And so if for anybody who'd like to send email, my address is my first initial C for Charlie, C.Dobbin, D-O-B-B-I-N, so C.Dobbin at mzmedia.com. So C.Dobbin, mzmedia.com. Here is a note from Ingrid. And Ingrid says, "Hi guys, it's me again. Thank you for the tip for my beautiful hibiscus. No, it was not a giraffe, but that nasty beetle dining on the leaves. Since the cheesecloth, it has stopped." So that's good. So she had Japanese beetles obviously chewing on her hibiscus. "Now," she says, "I'm battling with a new pest. In my jungle bedroom, I am finding little white, almost like cotton, on the underside of a beautiful Dracaena plant. Would you know what it could be? If anyone can figure it out, it's you guys. Love your show. Thank you, Ingrid." Right. You know what it is when it's little cotton, white little cotton blobs on any of your tropical plants, and you won't typically see this insect on anything but tropical plants, and that is mealybug. So mealy, M-E-A-L-Y, mealybug. If you want to look that up in one of your garden books or one of your favorite garden websites. But mealybug is a tough one to kill. like really tough. It's a very slow moving insect. It doesn't fly. It has no wings. It can't get away from you. But it is very, very, it's evolved to protect itself. It produces that white cottony looking stuff, which is a waxy coating. It produces that waxy coating, covers its body with the waxy coating, and nothing can get through. You know, you can spray all you want, and it's very, very hard to kill them. There's no chemical that, you know, on the market that will kill them. However, when I was talking with my friend Sean James, who you might recall has been on the show a number of times and is a very talented horticulturalist, he said, what I've done with mealybug is I get out a Q-tip, I take 100% pure rubbing alcohol, dip my Q-tip into it, and then I go around and I dab and literally dab and kill each mealybug one at a time. The problem is that with a plant that grows like this Dracaena, you've got that rosette growth, right? You've got that central growing tip is way down in the center, and the outer leaves, of course, are the older leaves, and the newest leaves are in the middle, and the little mealybugs can hide down in there, and you can't get at them. But he said he has sprayed, and he said he sprays 100% rubbing alcohol on a plant that's infested with mealybug, leaves the rubbing alcohol very briefly, maybe 10 minutes or so, and then has the plant in the bathtub, turns the shower on and rub, or takes it outside and washes off the rubbing alcohol. So he said that's worth a try with the Dracaena, because you can get that rubbing alcohol sprayed right down into that central point where those little pests will hide. So you're trying to get them where you can't see them, but the liquid alcohol, literally rubbing alcohol, will slither down and do a number down in there and hopefully kill them. But keep an eye on that plant and isolate it from all your other plants. Because even though mealybugs can't fly and move really slowly, they do transfer from plant to plant. And it's usually on us. We don't even realize that we are picking up a mealybug when we're stroking or touching one plant and we're moving to another plant and taking it with us. So don't do that. Isolate that plant, and you know, good garden hygiene will prevent that insect from moving anywhere to any of your other plants. And if you're unable to kill that mealybug before winter sets in, you may have to give up the Dracaena and just leave it out. The mealybug will die in the frost. They will not survive outside, which is why we typically don't see them outside. And they do love coming in on our plants when we bring them in. So be careful of that. All right. My next email, you know what we'll do? This next email is kind of a long one. So why don't we take our final break, and I'll be back to share with you an email from, oh, I know, I'm going to have to look this up. This is Ina Eisen, I believe, and it's all about aster yellow virus in coneflower. So kind of an interesting question. Janet Thompson started the question, but another listener and writer also wanted to understand what's going on with their coneflower. So stay tuned. We'll be right back to break down the difference between aster yellow virus and other sort of diseases of coneflowers that cause some very strange growth.
Don't change stations just because the weather changes. Garden tips and advice all year round. This is The Garden Show with Charlie Dobbin, exclusively on Zoomer Radio.
Yeah, so if anybody has been growing and noticing some very odd, distorted growth in their coneflowers or echinacea, which Janet from St. Mary sent an email to ask me about, she wanted me to discuss the aster yellow virus that's hitting coneflowers. She said, I read a lot about it, and the only option is to pull the affected plants. I have numerous varieties and numbers of coneflowers that I considered a collection, but now I'm pulling plants frequently. Do you know of any research that could save our beloved flowers? And I was like, oh, wow, that's quite a big thing. Now, just in case Janet is listening, or anybody who is listening wants to go to a great website where there's a real great breakdown between aster yellows and another issue with coneflowers, just Google coneflower cleanup. And that's actually what it's called, cone flower cleanup, and that comes out of Ohio State University. And I'm actually going to Google it myself right now because it is one of those things that I'm just going to double check. It's a cone flower cleanup. And so this cone flower cleanup is it's very, very good because it shows you aster yellow's symptoms. And of course, cone flowers or echinacea have long been, grown in landscapes. They're naturalized. They're very, very attractive. They're wonderful pollinator support plants. And of course, we many of us love them if we have a nice hot sunny spot to grow them. Now, if we start noticing some really weird growth on the flowers, the question is it cone flower rosette mite or is it a phytoplasma disease known as aster yellows? So aster yellows, as I mentioned, is a viral-like disease. It is caused by a phytoplasma. Insects that suck the sap of plants, especially the aster leafhopper, vector the disease. So that means that they carry the disease from plant to plant. The disease affects over 300 species of plants, including plants such as asters, obviously, but also coneflowers, zinnias, marigolds, chrysanthemums, petunias, snapdragons, even edibles like lettuces and carrots and tomatoes can end up with this viral-like disease. Now, the disease is called aster yellows. It is primarily transmitted by leafhoppers. Leafhoppers hop from leaf to leaf, and they have little mouth parts that pierce the leaves, and they suck juice out of the leaves, but they leave behind some of this phytoplasma, which is the disease that now becomes integrated into the plants where they have stuck their little mouth parts. Something to note, of course, that often environmental impact is important when it comes to the spread of diseases. And as it turns out, aster yellows is worse in cool, wet summers. And we've been lucky because we had a real nice, hot, dry summer this year, which was not favorable for the spread of either the leafhoppers or the phytoplasma that they might have been carrying. But the question is, there's a somewhat similar appearing problem on coneflowers that's caused by a little tiny mite. So a mite is a form of spider. You will never see these mites with your naked eye. You'll need a magnifying glass. But experts are still sorting out this problem. Whether it's the mite, and it's actually even an unnamed mite because there's so many mites out there, they can't keep on top of naming them all. At present, the common name used for the disorder caused by this mite is coneflower rosette mite. It may be a controllable problem through sanitation practices. So that's what, of course, our writer Janet was talking about, is the disposal of all affected flowers as they appear and all foliage in the fall. Unlike aster yellows, for which there's no cure other than to destroy infected plants. So that's the challenge. Trying to diagnose, what have I got here? Have I got aster yellows, or do I have this mite causing this weird distorted growth? So like I said, go to this coneflower cleanup. It's under the Ohio State University site, and some wonderful photographs showing you the difference between mite damage and aster yellows damage. And bottom line, you may have to pull the plants if it appears that you have aster yellows, but you may be able to avoid the mite in the future by removing all flowers as they emerge with these strange growths, and of course not composting, not keeping them on the property. And then as well, in the fall, before winter, cutting the entire plant right down to ground level, and again, either burning or disposing of all that plant material off your property. So I hope that helps. It is a very it's an ongoing issue. There's no straight answers. And I hope that anybody who is suffering with distorted coneflowers does get some more information and can figure out the right thing to do to avoid spreading that disease around, more so than it already is. But then on the other hand, keeping our echinacea, our coneflowers, as do the bees and the butterflies and the birds, and all kinds of biodiversity is supported with coneflower. So, you know, super favorite plants, and we hate to pull them if we don't have to. So good luck with that, Janet. Let me know if I can help in any other way. That was Janet writing in from St. Mary's. So here's my email one more time. C for Charlie, dot Dobbin, D-O-B-B-I-N, at mzmedia.com. Feel free to send an email, and I will do my best to read email on upcoming shows. I don't have a lot of time to answer your emails directly, but I'll do my best to, you know, bring your questions to all of our listeners. And remember, next week, Lori DeMonte joining us from Who Does Your Garden. Nice to hear a different voice, and particularly since you just listened to my only voice for an entire hour. That must have been a bit exhausting for some of you. I hope everything's going well in your gardens and that you're going to have a wonderful day. Get on that crabgrass. Don't let those seeds, you know, form and start, you know, popping all over your lawns and gardens. You do not want thousands of crabgrass seeds all over the place. So get pulling crabgrass today and enjoy the rest of your week. And I will see you all again next week.
This has been an exclusive podcast of The Garden Show with Charlie Dobbin. Heard every Saturday morning at 9 on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.